Yes, during this weekend, I thought we would go into question. It states on the leaflet that we would discuss order and creativity, but I'm not sure that we will begin with the question of order. We have been thinking it over. We will begin by discussing the question of meaning. We want to bring in creativity, and order will come in also. Does everybody hear me?
No.
Is that all right? Am I audible now? Right?
Yes.
Right. Also, I thought we would try to have a dialogue if we can, to be able to discuss freely among us. Perhaps in the beginning, the questions will be directed toward me, but I hope that it will become a talk. People will be talking with each other more and more as the meeting, as the weekend proceeds. Now, so it's very important that we should have a good contact. You see, that we feel free to talk to each other, and feel free to interrupt me, for example, at any time, if it's not clear. If you want further, or if you want to discuss the point. Now, the first question is, why discuss meaning, right? I don't know if it seems strange to you to be discussing this. Perhaps everybody feels he knows what meaning is. But if you think about it a while, you'll see it's not so simple. The question of meaning is very important. You see, we usually take it for granted, but everything depends on meaning. Not only communication, all thought, everything we do, the whole of society, and our whole being. This is the point I'm going to try to bring out, you see. Now, you could ask what is meant by the word meaning. That is a sort of a more subtle question, because we have brought in the word meaning twice, right? See, that's a tricky question, right? If you ask, what is the meaning of meaning? See, usually we take meaning for granted. So, say everybody knows what meaning is, but if I bring up the word meaning, every word has got to have a meaning, so the word meaning has got to have a meaning too. So what is the meaning of the word meaning? This raises something more subtle than you would think at first sight. Because, first of all, we talk about the meaning of this, the meaning of the word, of buildings, of people, of relationships, of money, of physics, or of anything. There are thousands of examples of meaning, or an infinite number of examples. But when we just take the word meaning by itself, we are discussing something much more profound and deeper. As the word meaning has a meaning which is the whole process of what is meant by meaning. So that includes significance. It also includes value. If you say something, it means a lot to me, it means it has high value. Now, you see, value is a very important thing, because according to what is valuable to you, you will act, right? The values determine one's action. It also includes intention. You see, I mean to do it, it's the same as I intend to do it. It's my purpose to do it. So meaning is also purpose. So the whole of life is involved in this. If you say purpose, intention, value, significance, the whole of life is penetrated by this, right? Now, I want to say, the point I'm going to make is, first of all, I'll say that usually, when we usually use the word meaning, we make a separation between meaning and what is, and being. We say there is something, and besides that, I mean something, right? There is a chair, and I mean, my meaning is the significant, say, the word chair signifies chair, the object chair, right? So we take a distinction between significance or meaning, or purpose, intention, value, and being, right? Is that clear? That's common usage of the word, and it has a certain value. That is, it's quite right to say, whatever I mean by the chair is not exactly the same as the chair. First of all, it's what I mean is something that's going on in me, usually we think, and the chair is something else. The meaning may be similar to what the chair is. It may reflect the chair, but there's a clear distinction between them. But, yes?
Do you see that meaning and value are not always associated, or do you see them as associated?
I see them, value is a kind of meaning.
Kind of meaning. Okay.
Yeah. And significance also, and value, significance, and purpose or intention. They're all kinds of meaning, right? Is that?
The word interpretation has to come in there.
Meaning. Interpretation is meaning also.
Right.
It's another, good. That's a further explanation of the word meaning, right?
Like what did you mean? What's the meaning?
Yeah. Explain, importance is another kind of meaning, right? If something means a lot to me, it's important to me, right? Interpretation means to transfer the meaning between one, say one language and another, or one person and another, to say, what do you mean?
Interpretation.
Yeah.
If we don't give the same interpretation of what's being said, we're not getting the meaning.
Well, we have a different meaning. You see, we...
That is the meaning.
What?
If we give the same interpretation.
Well, but we may both be wrong, you see.
Then there's no meaning.
Yeah. But you see, the first problem is, can we have the same meaning? And the second one is, will it be right? Now, will the meaning correspond to the real, to the thing, where, you know, the real thing? See, if we mean, suppose we say, well, I don't know, what is the meaning of anything, what the
start simple and say, pass the salt.
What?
You can start simply and say, pass the salt, and if
yes.
I don't give the same meaning
yeah.
to the words, then you get, don't get salt.
That's right. Well, that's very simple, yes. But now we could get more complicated, right? Well, we could say, what is the meaning of freedom, of justice?
That's the whole other end of the spectrum.
Yeah. Or in between, we have all sorts of things. Right. Now, if we can't give the same meaning, or essentially the same meaning, then we are going to have a failure of communication, right? But that's one of the problems of society, that people don't give the same meaning. It's very common.
Even if they use the same words?
Yes. I mean, well, the word justice could mean almost anything to different people, right? You see, it means that I get my justice to me, or you, to you it may mean justice to you, right? It's the word freedom, for example. People argue about it, fight over it.
I wondered, when you opened the discussion, I thought that you were going to talk about in referring to meaning, you were going to talk about meaning of life.
I would like to talk about that, yes.
I see.
I was trying to, we were starting very simply first.
Yeah, meaning would have something to do with relationship, also the relationship to whatever you're discussing.
Yes. Yes, that's clear, because according to what something means to you, that's how you're related to it. Right? You see, see, if something means has a great deal of meaning to you, you know you're strongly related. If it has no meaning to you, then you're indifferent to it. Huh? Or you can say that person, you know, being related to that person means a lot, or that relationship means that I'm secure, right? Or that I'm not secure.
Well, even if they see the same thing, just like I just talked to two people that came back from Hong Kong just tonight, one of them loved it, one of them didn't, and they told me all the meanings it meant to them that they didn't like, and the other told me all the meanings that they did like. It was the same object.
That's right. You see, but they see the same object, but it means something different. That's where communication fails, right? So, it
could you say then, if I understand you, that we're agreeing on the same meaning?
Well, we have got to have some sort of agreement on meaning to have a common understanding, right?
So there are two parts to the word to a meaning. One is the personal part, and one is the non-personal part. For well, example, if I spoke Greek and nobody else understood Greek, it would be, it wouldn't have any meaning to one who didn't understand it at all.
No.
Gibberish. But at the same time, you take a word like freedom. Although two people may differ on it, who understand, who know the word, who speak English, they may differ on what it means to them, the value of the word to them, but they would understand what it they would have some basis for understanding. So there are two parts to it. One is the personal and one is the non-personal.
Yes, well, meaning is probably primarily social in the sense that if we are cultural, you see, if we, it's very unlikely, there would be some very limited range of meanings that would arise if we were isolated individuals. You see, without some common social relationship and culture and communication, meaning would not develop very much. Now, so if you have different languages, then these don't, the only meaning is that they're sounds. But once we get to know the language, then it means a lot more. Now, the word freedom has a vaguely similar meaning to everybody, or some similarity, but there are very important differences, not only different individuals, but in different cultures. For example, you can see throughout the world that there are several cultures where freedom has totally different meanings, and there's a tremendous fight goes over on about it. You see.
Is there an underlying reality of freedom that we're trying to describe?
Well, that's what we want to explore, you see. See, I'm trying to say this whole discussion, the whole spirit of our discussion this weekend is we are not going to start from a conclusion but try to explore the thing, and I don't think we're quite ready to say if there's an underlying reality to freedom that may come out. You see, somebody might assume that there's an underlying reality to freedom, but on what basis can you assume it? Eh?
Is there meaning? The problem, I think, with looking at the word meaning is that the simplicity of the word, really what something is, the fact of what it is, which is ever-changing, that reality is not conditioned. But when one is looking at a word, freedom, which is conditioned by culture, conditioned by, you know, somebody is brought up in the Soviet Union, somebody is brought up in the United States, somebody is brought up in Europe, and by an educational conditioning process, the word freedom takes on a different meaning, which is coming from the past. But when the meaning is seen as what it is, simply what it is, there in the moment, then there's no condition to the meaning.
Well, we would like to be in a situation where we're free of conditioning to meaning, but see, usually when people talk, and there's every word is loaded in some way, or most words are likely to have a loaded meaning, as they used to say, having some emotional charge, and some words very little and some words more. Now, so when people are talking, the fact that the meaning is conditioned comes in. You see, now I think we haven't gone very far into why meaning should be conditioned or how they get conditioned, you know, what it means that they are conditioned. You see that, we have sort of raised the question at this moment of the conditioning of meaning, implying that there are two kinds of meaning. One is unconditioned and the other is conditioned. So there would be a direct perception of a new meaning, for example, which we would say would be unconditioned, but most meanings that we generally use are taken for granted as we communicate, and we sort of are bathed, we live in this conditioned meaning, right? Now, especially as we engage in all the activities of society where you pretty well have to do that to be able to get along, right?
Talk about conditioned meaning and unconditioned meaning. Now, I guess conditioned meanings are, all the conditioned meanings are given meanings. Am I right to say so?
Well, you see, I think we're going a bit too fast. The question is, what is the nature of this conditioning of meaning? We wanted to get into that. You see, why should meanings be restricted and conditioned? See, one of the conditionings is that I have my meaning, you have yours, and so on, right? Or one culture has one meaning, another culture has another meaning. See, a lot of the conditioning we don't know about because it's cultural conditioning, right? Now, if everybody in the culture practically has the same conditioning, it's extremely hard for anybody to know he's got it, right? If everybody speaks English with the same accent, then we all think we have no accent, right? Therefore, one of the points that's going to come up is that this cultural conditioning, you see, which is not really very conscious, is one of the major forms of conditioning, right? Now, besides that, you have your own particular individual conditioning, but most of that is cultural, too. You see, everybody there's the general culture, and then everybody is living in his own subculture, which is a bit different. These various subcultures don't communicate entirely. They're somewhat isolated. And people in one subculture may find one meaning. You see, in the same country, there may be many subcultures. There are, right? There are different. You can easily say, even in this town of Ojai, probably find a number of them, where the same concept means something very different to different people. Now, when you're talking with somebody, you see, you are talking from your subculture or culture, and the other person from another one. And therefore, there's disagreement. Or else you're in your own subculture, and you are stuck with certain assumptions. You see, all these meanings are going based on certain assumptions, right?
But you brought up the word, I think, or someone earlier brought up the word direct perception.
Mm-hmm.
Now, presumably, in a direct perception, where there's nothing between the perception and that which is being perceived, this conditioning would not exist. And
yes.
The question is, how does one know that there is a direct perception?
Yes, that's one of the dangers, you see, because you may be assuming there's direct perception, and but then this may be deceptive, right? You see, that's what one of the things we want to be going into. You see, I think more or less we're sort of indicating the direction in which the discussion might take in the next 2 days. It's easy enough to assume that there is direct perception, but you don't know. You see, very often you can see other people who claim to have direct perception, and you suspect they don't. They may think the same about you, right?
I think the problem is that where thought is involved in any way whatsoever, there can't be any direct perception. Because thought, because it's coming from the past, can't be a direct perception, something direct. There's no barrier. Where there's knowledge coming in, it's coming from the past, that's a barrier to the direct perception of what is.
Yes, you see, but now the question is what to do about that. You see, if we take all the people in a certain subculture who are conditioned with certain meanings, like people speaking the same accent, they don't know that they're conditioned, you see. You see, will this direct perception tell you that you are conditioned by your subculture? I'm not saying it will or it won't, but that's the question.
Well, it's a great assumption. In the space probe, where they sent out the symbols indicating man and so forth and so on, wasn't this the supreme expression of hope that alien beings would be able to understand what was being sent?
Yes, well, yes, I mean, I don't know that that was a hope, but I don't know. That was this program where they put the figure of a man and a woman on some piece of metal and various symbols of different kinds, but they might not be recognized at all by totally different beings. You know, for example, the dolphins would probably depend mainly on sound anyway, and these visual forms wouldn't mean so much. But that's an extreme case of imagining a culture of totally different beings.
There was an assumption with that plaque that any intelligent form of life in the universe would recognize, for instance, switching on and off processes or counting and things like that. They would be able to measure and they would recognize hydrogen and things like that. So that they were trying to get out of some very basic things in the universe, and that would be the basis of meaning if somebody else were to see that plaque.
Yeah, then that's an assumption. You see, the point is that underlying the conditioning of meaning is certain assumptions about what these meanings are, right? Now, most of these assumptions are tacit. They're not explicitly stated ever. And in fact, you never know you make them because you sort of absorb them from your subculture. Let's say that particular assumption is absorbed from a certain subculture of scientists working in a certain way. All of these people probably feel that it's quite natural and inevitable to make that assumption. They don't even think it's an assumption, perhaps. And there's very little, as long as they stay in that subculture, there's very little to tell them that they're making an assumption. Right? which may or may not be true.
A few minutes ago you said unconditioned meaning. You may say that we are going too fast, but still I'm curious to ask. It sounds like contradictory statement, unconditioned meaning.
Well, perhaps it is. You see, we're exploring it. Now, we might change the word to say, let's try to distinguish two extreme kinds of meaning. One is well known. You know, everybody knows about it. It's from the past, and it's fairly simple, right? Now, another is you see a new situation, and you say, what does it mean? Something new. And you have to see it, perceive it. You don't see it with the eyes only, because it may, you have to see it with the mind, right? Now, therefore, there is I would rather discuss the possibility of perceiving a new meaning, right, as distinguished from going on with some variation of the old meanings.
It may be a reconditioning, just a reconditioned meaning.
It may be, but it may not. You see, let me give you an example. I'll take it from physics, because I've thought about that more. It should be easy enough to understand, I hope, to those who are not physicists. this Newton, you know, now one of his most important discoveries was the law of universal gravitation, that every object attracts, and the universe attracts every other with a gravitational force, right? Now, if you go back into the history of this, you go back, say, 2,000 years or so to the ancient Greeks, and they said there was a basic difference between earthly matter and heavenly matter. Earthly matter was highly imperfect, and it moved up steadily toward the heavens, toward perfection. And therefore, they thought heavenly matter was totally different from earthly matter. Now then, gradually, after the Middle Ages, evidence accumulated this is not so, you see. For example, you find the moon has irregularities on it, which are highly imperfect and look like mountains, rather like the Earth. I mean, and you find all sorts of things going on in the, you know, which are very similar between the Earth and the heavens, right? But the moon, essentially, it's implied as a large piece of rock, right? So the now. There's a question arose. You see, if you ask somebody, why doesn't the moon fall? See, in ancient times, it was not a difficult question because the moon is very different from objects near the Earth, which fall. Their property is to fall, and heavenly matter is quite different, right? So there was no problem. But now, with new evidence accumulating, saying the moon is a big hunk of rock, see, nobody asked the question, why isn't it falling, right? Because they took it for granted that the moon is celestial matter, which is quite different from earthly matter, and stays up in the sky where it belongs. See, for ages that people have been thinking that way, and that's conditioning, right? You don't know you have conditioning, you just do it, right? That's the whole point of conditioning, is you don't know it. You don't know anything about it. If you knew about it, you probably wouldn't do it, right? But Newton, you see, the story is, the legend is, that he was reputed to have been watching the apple fall from the apple tree. And he probably asked himself, here's the apple falling, why isn't the moon falling? So his answer was, it is falling, right? And that was, he said, everything is falling toward everything. That is universal gravitation. And he could then explain why it didn't reach the ground by following its orbit, saying that it was going on a circular, was falling but moving outward on the circular orbit at the same time. It worked it all out. Now, so there was an insight there, a moment of insight, a moment of seeing a new meaning. You see, previous, yeah?
Sorry. But that new meaning is based on first seeing that the idea that all things fall. So searching for a new meaning was based on another new meaning.
Yeah, well, he saw a new meaning that all things fall. You see, the previous meaning was some things mean earthly matter, which falls, and other things mean heavenly matter, which don't fall, right? So he suddenly saw a new meaning, which is all things are the same matter. Well, if earthly matter falls, heavenly matter falls.
Would you say that the first meaning was based on an assumption, on a theoretical assumption, and the second meaning was based on observation?
Well, look, it's a little more subtle than that. You see, there's an assumption which gradually was really taken, it was never made consciously, it was taken for granted that earthly matter is different from heavenly matter. The real act of perception was the discovery that you have this assumption. You see, nobody knew that he was assuming it. That's the real problem. If you knew you were assuming it, you could stop assuming it.
Yes.
Right?
But by watching the apple fall...
No, that didn't tell me. Millions of people have watched apples falling. You see, nothing happens.
But didn't that set into motion something else in terms of...
Well, no, the apple falling was just an incident that was useful. But see, the point is his mind was prepared by knowing that heavenly matter... He had a lot of evidence in the back of his mind, as all the scientists of the time had, that heavenly matter is not really different from earthly matter. But there was a conditioned mind which went on with the same old program that said heavenly matter... That was in one compartment of the mind, but the other compartment was heavenly matter is quite different from earthly matter, and people automatically thought that way without noticing they're doing it.
And they thought that was based on observation.
They didn't even think they would... See, they just took it for granted. You see, you must see the power of conditioning is that you don't know that it's there at all. It just works like a computer program working quite automatically.
You just run on a bunch of assumptions.
But the assumption, you don't know you've got them.
Right, but that's what's happening.
That's what's happening, but you think it's the truth.
You don't probably don't even think about it.
You don't think, if you did think about it, you would say, of course, it's quite evident. It's okay.
And this assumption is created through the evolution of meanings.
Yes, we take meanings for granted, right?
And meaning starts and creates, and that meaning is taken as an assumption, and then that creates a basis on which to make more meaning.
Yeah. And everybody agrees, you see. One of the ways of testing for whether you're on the right line is consensus, everybody agreeing, right? Mm-hmm. Here you have everybody agreeing, it's nice.
How many people agreed with him at the time?
Well, most tacitly, they never even raised the question, but tacitly, implicitly, everybody was...
What? When he explained it to other people, did they...
Well, those who were immediately, they could see right away, the best scientists could see right away that he was right. You see, other people took a little longer, but you see it... But the real thing was how to break through that conditioning. You see, once he saw it, then it was much easier for somebody else to see it, provided his mind wasn't too rigid.
I think one of the most powerful ones that mankind had, really, was the work for the earth was flat. That seemed to be sensible, even. So it's only by physically actually discovering it wasn't could it ever be changed?
Well, it was changed by insight again. You see, some of the ancient Greeks saw evidence that the earth was round. They even postulated it was a sphere and estimated its size and weren't too far off. You see, there was quite a bit of indirect evidence which suggested it wasn't flat. And in fact, this evidence was around for a long time. Now, the thing which convinced people finally was going around it, but but just simply not taking for granted the evidence of the immediate experience was the first step. You see, to be able to question common sense and immediate experience was the crucial step. Now, that is exceptionally difficult.
What is critical?
To be able to question what everybody takes for granted.
Okay.
You see, that's the act of perception has its root in that.
Newton had a direct perception of the new meaning.
Yeah.
And it was only later on, through consensus, that it acquired became a social meaning.
Yes.
It was, at one point in time, it was a direct perception of one individual.
Yeah.
Now, what is it that makes for a direct perception in other individuals of this new meaning?
Well, I think he explained, I'm not sure I get your question, but the way it looks seems to me is Newton could explain what he'd done to other people, and they would see the point too, right?
Right, but it has to, it's, why isn't it just a subjective, how was he able to explain it that they saw directly perceived it for themselves and didn't say that, attributed it as a personal interpretation? Of
well, no, that may have happened later still. You see, I think that in the beginning, he explained it, and somebody says, yes, I see it, you're right. Later on, it was taught to students and said, there it is, the formula, and so on. It's all in the book, and you accept.
So the formula is the vehicle for communicating the direct perception.
No, because these people didn't. Once you learn it from the formula, it could be. But let's say, but in general, if you don't, if you stick to the formula alone, then it becomes merely accepting an assumption without understanding what it's about, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, up until just this century, did anybody question how the sun gave off so much heat? It was just assumed that the sun.
Well, yeah. Well, people did question it. You see, and some people saw there was a problem. You see that. They said, you know, if it were coal burning, it wouldn't last very long. And, you know, they raised questions of that nature, and they thought maybe the gravitational force gave off energy as the sun collapsed, but they thought that might last for a few million years. But you see, people were raising those questions from time to time, right?
Was part of Newton's communication the fact that he had broken through the condition that he had started to question? And that the people that he was trying to, the initial group that understood him, did they also break through the conditioning?
Well, it was much easier. You see, Newton had to break through. See, you have to look at the nature of the conditioning, which is, it's not some mysterious thing. You see, it's something which is very immediate. It's just what everybody's taking for granted without knowing they're doing it. So the kind of sharpness or penetration or intensity of mind which becomes aware of that is what ends that conditioning, right? Now, once he's done it, then on this particular point, he can then communicate to another scientist. But he doesn't necessarily communicate that intensity, which will enable them to do the same thing on some new problem.
I think he said that he observed something until it revealed itself.
Yes, but then
that's
right. But then I think I would put it that he observed something until it ceased to conceal itself.
Why is that different?
Well, it's different in the sense that you want to say reveal means emphasize it's coming out. But I think the key problem is concealment at this stage, that the mind, by taking something for granted, is concealing the fact. And therefore, the major, if you could say, revealing consists of removing the veil of concealment. That's one image I could give you.
Now, the scientists who learned from Newton that everything was falling, now that was a new kind of conditioning.
Well, in the beginning, if they really understood it, it wasn't. But as people began to repeat, then it's conditioning.
But once they knew it, wouldn't that be a conditioning which was more in accord with the facts, but still conditioning?
That's true, yes. You see, that's the point, that gradually Newton's law became another form of conditioning instead of the ancient Greek law. And then Einstein came along and said Newton's law is not entirely true, as he had some insight of a similar nature, and so on, right? Now, therefore, you can see that a great deal of the progress of science depends on that conditioning. See, some of it is necessary, obviously, to be able to work. For example, it's the same as the conditioning to drive on the right-hand side of the road. You don't question it because you see the point. But the dangerous kind of conditioning is the kind that you just take for granted and don't know you have. Right? Some conditioning is obviously necessary. If you're conditioned to be able to speak this language, you can't speak another one, right? If you go to another country, you've got to learn the other language, and that's another kind of conditioning. But within that language, there may be assumptions that you don't know are there, which would affect your behavior, right? Do you see what I mean? So conditioning has its place, but it has its danger.
Say we're sometime going to have to get to the place where we go from the difference between physical meaning and physical conditioning to psychological. I mean, the physical is back into, you say, driving on the right hand of the road is a physical thing that we do, but then that doesn't cause us a lot of problems.
It may, because suppose you go to another country where they drive on the left hand side, and you may find yourself driving on the wrong side of the road.
Break that conditioning almost immediately and go to the left.
Yeah, you can. Before you do it, you may get killed.
But if you thought it was real and absolute like we do psychologically, then you probably would get killed.
Yeah, well, you see, but you don't have any strong psychological preference for right or left, but still you have a psychological preference for whatever you're used to. And therefore it's more comfortable to stick with what you're used to. And therefore if you went to England, you would have to watch out for that. Because if nobody was on the road, you might find it more comfortable to drift over to the right-hand side. And therefore, you can't, it's not easy to separate the physical and the psychological.
So if Newton had a direct perception and Einstein had a direct perception, and the two, and the one direct perception, in a sense, contradicted the other, what is the nature of direct perception?
Well, no, you see, that's only if you assume that what Newton said was absolutely true, that there was a contradiction, you see. If you suppose, Newton proposed some laws which were assumed then to be completely and absolutely correct. Einstein said Newton's laws are not, you know, are fairly good in a certain domain, but when looked at in a domain of high speeds compared with that of light, they're not. So, therefore, what Newton saw was a limitation on Einstein. What Einstein saw was a limitation on Newton's law. What was contradicted was the assumption that Newton's law has an unlimited validity.
Yeah, but what I'm asking is, what is the nature of direct perception then?
Well,
I mean, if they were both direct perceptions.
Each one perceived the conditioning. I say the most direct perception was the perception of the conditioning that was taken for granted, you see.
Was that communicated, that that was the most
direct? No, that wasn't. You see, that's the point. But people then focus on the next step and say that was the most perceptive step, you see. Seeing the conditioning, in my view, is the first most direct perception. And then it was fairly simple once you saw, once Newton saw that, to say, why isn't the moon falling if it's a hunk of rock?
I wonder if it would help to bring this out, to bring in the concept of concepts, and whether celestial matter was a concept that he saw through.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's... you know, it might be better to do that when we have more time to discuss, because that could take us a long story, right? I regard this as a sort of a general sketch or introduction to get into it. And so we're in this question of the conditioning of meaning, right? And part of it is just, it's just taking something for granted. That's a very important kind of conditioning which you don't know you have, right? And in fact, you could say that in some way all conditioning has that nature. You see, there's some assumption which you're taking for granted, which is behind it. Suppose we say you assume that a road is a good road, a level road, or that this floor will support you, you see. Therefore, you walk in a certain way, your body is disposed in a certain way. Of course, there might be a hole in there under the carpet, and then if you once found that out, then you would have a different disposition in walking, right? You see, according to the assumption, the whole system is disposed, the body, right? The emotions are disposed according to your assumption as well, right? And so on. So now that disposition acts without consciousness, right? Without thought. You may thinking... the assumption may be put consciously by thinking it, but once you have made it, the disposition requires no further conscious thought, right? So therefore, assumptions, we have to say there's a connection between assumptions and actions, which is through the disposition. And when the disposition becomes fixed, because the assumption is fixed, then you are conditioned to act without knowing what you're doing, right? You see, when you make a mistake or something happens, you can then become aware of that assumption. That's not a serious problem. But if you're taking this assumption for granted so much that you can't be aware of it, then you have a serious problem, because you will act according to it, but not know you've got it.
Isn't this what most of us do?
That's where the problem of humanity is, in a way you could put it, that this is a problem which is in the human condition. It does not belong to anybody in particular. Right? The human condition is such at this stage of development that society has come out, has grown up with individuals, vast numbers of assumptions, which are taken for granted, and which we operate through the dispositions, right? You see, if you assume that your country is always right, you will be disposed to defend it, right? No matter what happens, right?
Like when you're walking and you trip because you're clumsy, and then you look back to find the thing you tripped over and it's not there.
Well, then you made a wrong assumption. You see, you said I tripped because something was there. You see, then you would have to say I tripped because I walk clumsily, right? Right? Now, but then you might not like to say that. You might say my self-image is of a person who is very agile and graceful, and it would cause me discomfort to think that I was clumsy. So therefore, you would say no, it couldn't be that I was clumsy. I assumed that I tripped because of some hidden obstacle, or some other reason, which you see. So you get into all that, which we'll discuss tomorrow, into self-deception, right? You see. So the point is that we are conditioned by these assumptions, by the dispositions, not knowing that they're there, and even having some tendency, a considerable tendency, not to want to know. Now, that I suggest, is rather a dangerous thing to be in, right? And especially if the whole human race is in it. it always was a bit dangerous, but let's say during the Stone Age, it was not all that bad, because people could not, their ability to hurt each other was very limited. But as, as technology developed further and further, the thing got more dangerous, not only so that we can now destroy civilization and everything, but most of the planet, but also not only through war, but also ecologically and other ways, we have a disposition to act in certain ways based on certain assumptions, so as to gradually destroy the planet, right? And in fact, if those assumptions are not changed, those dispositions, another kind of very serious crisis may develop, or probably will. So in some way, it seems to me that, many people have felt this, that the human race is approaching a critical situation. It can't go on with this old way, which we've described. I mean, not fully, but it sort of indicated. And many people feel that there really is danger, at the very least, of ending this civilization or of producing tremendous destruction on the planet in other ways. So, on the other hand, other people would prefer not to be aware of all this. You see, it's part of the whole structure of assumptions. They may make assumptions that all this is unduly alarmist, and so. Of course, they could say, then we could argue back and forth. But I'm just proposing this now as a thing to think about. We don't necessarily accept it, right? Yeah?
Do you suppose that in a primitive society there was more room for direct perception than there is in a complicated one technologically and otherwise today?
It may be true. You see, in some ways, the people probably had less conditioning. You see, in order to maintain this complex society, we have used a great deal of conditioning, which is enforced, not free to be questioned. And therefore, that is another problem, that how are we going to run a highly complex society with real freedom of the mind? You see, we come to the question, what does the word freedom mean? Now, one meaning of the word freedom is to be free of all this conditioning. I think it's the most important kind meaning of
it. It seems to me that, that the danger isn't more now and less then, because it seems that the danger is simply the danger in the human brain, the human consciousness of separation and separate meanings, separate assumptions, in which when one looks back throughout the whole of history, it may be a different form of conditioning, but it is still the same
human being the same conditioning. And so the danger is really that in that conditioning, there is no life. Because in seeing something through the past, in looking at it through an assumption, then there's no direct perception, there's no actual life, the living thing itself. And I think that is the true danger.
You know, that has always been the danger, that life would become meaningless if we follow this sort of approach, right? In other words, that if we proceed by taking assumptions for granted and not being conscious of them, life will lose its meaning. But I think in some ways, simple societies were able to have more meaning than in the present society, which has gotten into a very complicated situation. And there's an actual physical danger of extinction of the whole civilization, which is much greater than existed in primitive societies. Some tribes might be extinguished, but others might continue. If we're thinking of the question, will the human race survive long enough to solve this whole question? This is one of the first times when people might feel that maybe it won't. Whereas, say, 100 years ago, everybody felt, okay, there may be a lot of, all this is going on, but there is time at least for, we will go on existing, and perhaps we can hope that someday it will be solved, right? Now, I think the situation has changed, that it is now distinctly possible that there isn't that much time. You know, if the human race should go, or if the civilization should go, then all these questions would also go, right?
I wonder why time, though, enters into the question at all, because a direct perception itself has no time in it whatsoever. And to have time, let's say, to say, well, we have, you know, that time is there as a means to an end, would not be a direct perception, because direct perception is time being knowledge is again working with assumptions. And so direct perception is simply just here.
Yes, but and then we could raise the question, if somebody perceives here that the human race may still destroy itself, you see it very likely. I think the situation has changed, that assuming that there have been people occasionally who have had direct perception, the human race has still gone on more or less with its method. Now, you could argue that might go on indefinitely as long as you stayed in primitive conditions. But if the conditions are not primitive as they are, if the technology is highly advanced, then you say sooner or later it's not going to work. We won't even have that possibility, you see. We want to raise the question, if you talk about direct perception, we'd have to ask then, why isn't there direct perception? That is, we have had a million years and there hasn't been enough direct perception to stop the general course of events. In fact, it has moved on to this crisis.
I think the problem is that direct perceptions occur only in individuals, at one individual at a time. Only an individual can have a direct perception.
That's an assumption. It may not be true. You see, I'm not saying it is or isn't true.
I think we all make the assumption, too, that it's desirable to maintain life. I mean, the fear that mankind will come to an end is what creates a crisis.
Well, no, I shouldn't think. I think crisis has been here even before people thought it was coming to an end. You know, we've had this crisis going on, you know, wars and famines and, you know, massacres and using technology for destructive purposes and economic collapse and, you know. Now it's come to the point where people are wondering how long can it go on, right? Now, you see, but I wanted to come back to this other point. We may have to question whether perception is necessarily only an individual affair. because that may make it almost impossible to proceed, to really, you know, for anything to happen, right? Now, we don't know, you see. So that's one of the points to say that's something that I was hoping we could explore.
In that case, the question is, I think an assumption behind perception being an individual affair is that there's a distinction between perception and communication.
Yes, I want to question that distinction. I want to say that they flow into each other.
You're saying that there's an actual change, and that change is communicated regardless of whether you describe it or not.
Well, so no.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Then the question is, if there are people who have had direct perception in the past, and if perception and communication flow into each other, why doesn't the human race have direct perception today? And why are we
because I think we have to have a direct perception of the nature of perception and communication. You see, for example, we are now talking, right? Is it possible that in this talk a direct perception would arise among all of us in a dialogue, right? I don't give an answer to that. That, you know, that is what we can explore, right?
So it seems to me, in talking about direct perception, we may have a problem because you couldn't really ever say that anyone could have a direct perception. I mean, it may occur, but no one has it.
Yeah, that's quite true.
And,
yes.
So we're all in the same boat, so.
Well, nobody can hold it and say that's mine. You see. So unless the only thing is that other people can refuse to take it, you see.
could we say that one of the ways we validate our conditioning in a society is by assuming that we all have the same perception?
Well, that's one of the assumptions of the consensus, is that we all have the same perception. That may be a false assumption, you see.
Right. So this we assume, right, that we are perceiving the same thing. If we saw something that we all agreed upon in the middle of the room, and that agreement could be an assumption out of conditioning, we feel that we've had the same perception, but we haven't had any perception.
Maybe not, yeah, you see. See, for example, all the people in a certain nation may perceive that their nation is in danger and they must be loyal and patriotic and get excited and so on. They perceive the same danger and the same need for doing something, right? And that could all come out of the conditioning, out of the assumptions. Yeah.
Danger. But we all feel like we have the same perception.
Well, the feeling comes out of the assumption. You see, there may be an assumption that feeling is always spontaneous, but clearly, if you assume a certain thing, you will get the corresponding feeling. You see, if you assume somebody is an enemy, you will feel very hostile, right? And if you, for example, suppose I assume that a shadow is an assailant, this will produce all sorts of feelings. The heart will go faster, the adrenaline, everything, right?
So feelings are a result of our assumptions.
Sometimes, and very often, yeah. There may be a feeling which is part of a direct perception, see, but I want to say that not all feelings may come out of assumptions, but a tremendous number do, and there isn't a further assumption that people generally have that strong feelings don't come out of assumptions, but are directly coming out of me, right? Now, therefore, that is going to be a crucial assumption to look at.
And we learn these feelings through... See, one thing technology has done to us is helped us amalgamate our ideas of emotions. I mean, everybody watches the same movies now, and everybody reads the same books. In the old days, I don't know what they did. So that the idea of love has a feeling. And that feeling has been conditioned into us through...
That's
through
right. Yeah, well, yes, the feeling is affected by the assumption. You see, if you're watching the television, which is nothing but a set of spots of light, and you see the hero dangling over a cliff, you will feel the pit of your stomach is sinking, right? Just as you would feel if you were you were him, right? Dangling over the cliff. So that's clearly a set of assumptions that have made you feel that way, right?
Perception and assumption factor with Orson Welles' program, where all these people, and affected an awful lot of people, showing that this could happen with propaganda in the sense where it wasn't meant to be that way, caused an awful lot of emotion all over the United States.
Yeah, well, that was, I think, you're referring to the fact that a long time ago, Orson Welles broadcast a very realistic play on the radio about the Martians invading the Earth. And this, people were not who tuned in the middle didn't know it was a play, you see. It was so realistic that they became alarmed. But you see, it was only reasonable for them to become alarmed, but given those assumptions. But it shows the power of assumptions, that if you assume the Martians are coming, you will, I mean, if you assume that there's good evidence the Martians are coming, then you will feel all sorts of things.
Why do you say there's no distinction between perception and communication? If an individual has a perception, it's only over time that he can communicate it.
There's a time
involved between the perception and the communication.
I don't say there is. I say there often is or generally is such a distinction, but I'm saying need there be always such a distinction is the question I'm raising. Is that clear? Whether there cannot be another kind of perception in which there, which is not just simply one person sees and he communicates it.
So in that perception, presumably, there would, and the communication in that act, there would be no division of time. There would be no time involved between the act of perception and the act of communication.
Well, first of all, there would be this division between people would not be emphasized so much as it is in the previous state of affairs. You see, I think we could say no time, but the first point is to discuss the distinction between people, the mind, not physically, but mentally, right? And then the question of time could be raised. You see, I think that the time question comes in when you make a false separation.
If two minds, two brains, two people didn't have these assumptions, what is possible could be different than anything we've experienced.
So yes.
Then we wouldn't bring in the question of perception and communication. It would just happen.
Yes, well, since we are now bringing it in order to inquire. Now, so we would have meaning in this perception, whether individual or together. This new meaning, I'm going to say, is a change of being at the same time.
Yes.
Right. That is the key point. Right. Now, then, just one more point, then, that I say that in a dialogue, let's say, just for the sake of discussion, we might make a distinction between a dialogue and a discussion, you see. Discussion is where things go back and forth, it's like the word discussion is based on the same root as the word percussion and concussion. It means, roughly the idea transmitted is a ball being hit back and forth, right? That's a perfectly valid thing to do, but it's limited, right? Now, see, we have to do some of that, but is that all that we can do?
Talking or communion, which is going through something completely, because dia, to go through, it would be completely, so the ending of it, not that you'd see the completely, the thoroughness.
Yes, well, you can say that, as the root dialogue is dia logos, and if we say logos means the word, but it's really the meaning of the word. So if we say, but one image you could make is that there's the flow of meaning between, you see it through all of us, and to think of like the stream flowing through the country between the banks, right? And you see, so if the meaning were flowing in the groove, whereas this would be quite different from a discussion where the meaning is being bounced back and forth like a ball, right? So we might begin with a discussion. We hope it would gradually, suddenly, or whatever way, turn into a dialogue.
You want me to remind you?
Yeah. Okay, well, I think that now that's the time we agreed that we would finish, and we start then at 10 o'clock.